Welcome back to all those who are old timers here. No one's old, everyone's old timers. You know? Welcome to all the new faces here as well. I see a few new faces around. After probably about 7-8 years working on the mitzvos, so now we have a brand new topic for this season. It's our first brand new topic in a very long time. This is very exciting. After considering different options, I came up with this one, which hopefully everyone I think will appreciate. Those who saw the emails were calling it a second look. And today, I probably spend most of the time introducing the topic, and then we'll start probably really getting into the material more next week. But at least we'll introduce the topic right now so we can understand what we're trying to accomplish with this. A second look, what I mean by that is most of us are familiar with the basic stories of the Torah. You know, the sin of Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, the story of Noah, the story of Abraham, basic stories that we all know or are familiar with. We grow up with, but the problem is very often we only know the basic story, but we have no depth understanding it. It's just a very basic story. We see it from a very superficial level. We all understand deep down that the Torah has more to offer than a simple story, but we don't know how to chew up that story. We don't know how to appreciate it, to learn from it, to really size up what's happening. So a second look means let's go back to these stories that we all know and love and are familiar with, and let's give it a second look, but from a deeper perspective. And that's really our goal. We don't want to sell ourselves short with a superficial understanding of the Torah. We want to be sure that we understand things, you know, as they're meant to be understood. Now the truth is, every line of the Torah has infinite wisdom, and you could spend weeks and weeks on every single verse, every pasuk. We're not going to do that, but we're going to try to move through story by story. But we have to know that at least get a deeper glimpse of each story is a very important thing, and to know that the Torah is more than meets the eye. The stories remain in our minds very much. You know, if you learn them as a preschooler, and you learn the story of Noah, you know, Noah and his ark. So that sticks with you as that cute story as a preschooler. And as you become an adult and as you move through life, if you don't go back to it and look at it from an adult's eyes, an adult's lens, so then you still have that child's understanding. Just, you know, you picture all the little animals in the ark waving at you or something, and that's as far as it goes. Picture the story of Adam and Chava. And, you know, Chava's there with a snake at this tree, and like it's like a cartoon. It doesn't really like sit with us. What happened? Why, you know, these people are very high, lofty, spiritual people, and seems to us sort of like, I hate to say, like a silly story or a silly challenge they had. And you have to know deeper down, what is that challenge? And what are we trying to, what's the Torah trying to convey through that? What was that challenge exactly there? We'll try to talk about that. We have to know that there's a lot of different, I guess, caveats involved in this study. We know as Jews, we believe the Torah is God's wisdom is infinite. It's deep. There's nothing in the Torah which is shallow, which is a simple story. Everything is profound. Everything has layers and layers and layers of understanding, and you have to look at each layer for what it is. The people in the Torah are also people that are very big, very complex. We can't look at them as simplistic characters. They're spiritual, they're wise, their challenges and their accomplishments, whether they're failures or successes, they're on a different plane than we're used to. If we look at people in the Torah as people just like us, then we're missing the story. Because people who've made it into the Torah, who stand as symbols for all of humanity, for all eternity, obviously they are much more complex and much greater than a simple person living in our times. We have to look at them from that perspective. And the Torah, when it describes their actions, is describing it from that perspective. And it's a very important perspective to take. There's a problem that I think we all have also, a related problem, is that we project ourselves into the story. Meaning I say, well, if I was standing in a tree and God said not to eat it, and a snake came and said to eat it, I think I'd probably listen to God, not to the snake. But that's what all of us probably think in our minds. Like, what's the snake going to tell me that's going to convince me to go against God? If God himself came to me and said, don't eat that fruit, like, why would a snake, like, persuade me otherwise? Like, how foolish. The problem is we're projecting ourselves based on who we are, based on our times, based on our standing in life, into the story, which is actually a much more complex story on a much higher level. And it leads us to an incorrect understanding, you know, in a very major way. If we understand the people in the Torah as being the simple or foolish people, then we've missed the boat. And then we're selling ourselves short, because who loses out at the end? We do, because we don't understand the lesson which is there. And we're the ones who lose out. So the question is, how are you supposed to approach these stories? Because the way that they're worded in the Torah seems to be fairly straightforward, typically. The way that the challenges or the accomplishments or the failures are portrayed typically is pretty straightforward in the simple verses. So like, what's our role? What's our how do we open these stories up and understand what they are? How do we do that? So we've been given tools. One of the major differences that we have, much of the world looks at the Torah as a holy book. Christians certainly do. Even the Muslims do to some degree. But the difference is, we have the benefit of the oral tradition coming along with it, and others don't. We have commentators who have received that tradition and put the tradition into their commentaries, and others don't have that in the same way. And we have to understand the advantage of having the words of Chazal, the words of the sages, the words of the Rishonim, the primary commentators that we have in the Torah. They take for us the concepts, the stories, they distill it down to what's supposed to be given over by the Torah, they explain them, and they open it up for us in ways that the story actually has much more of a depth and meaning and doesn't just remain as a simple story. So if we use the benefits that we have of the classic commentaries, the benefits of the words of Chazal, it opens for us worlds of a much deeper understanding of these stories, to understand them on a much more, on a real level, on a more complex level than the simple reading. And that's how it's meant to be. And I think we have to be very, very careful in explaining. When we say, the Ramban says X, or Rashi says Y, or the Rambam says Z, so it's not, we don't mean this is his personal interpretation that he decided to make up one day. He's building it off of thousands of years of tradition. You can have differences in understanding, but when we have, let's say, what we quote Ramban, Nachmanides, and Ramban says, this is how you understand this story. So it's not that he was sitting down one day reading and said, oh, that's what I think it means. The Ramban is somebody who spent decades learning. He had his teachers. He toiled over the words of the Gemara, of the Talmud, of the Midrashim. He toiled over the words, and then with everything together, he said, this is what, through the tradition, how I've inspired to understand this. But it's not just his own personal, oh, I think it means this, I think it means that. And I think people often fall into the trap. People who are not scholars of that level for sure, or any level, just say, I think it means this. What do you mean you think it means this? I mean, maybe it does, but there's a story. There's a tradition. There's a tradition going back. Now, you're allowed to question, why does he think that's what it means? What's his proof to that? What's his source? But ultimately, the interpretations that we have of the Torah are based on tradition, based on sources, and a very careful analysis of the text. Another point to be made is that to understand the Torah, it's hard to get a full understanding until you see the whole picture. I mean, anyone can isolate one paragraph and say X, Y, or Z. But the great Torah scholars, they've taken it all in. They look at this paragraph, but it's in a context of the entire body of Torah writings. It's the entire Chumash, the entire Tanakh, it's all the Midrashim, it's all of the Gemara, it's all the commentaries, and with all that in mind, all that at their fingertips, now they give an explanation. And obviously, that's much more weighty and much more meaningful than a simple person reading a few lines and saying, oh, it must mean that. So I think many people step into that trap. And this, I mean, we all should learn Torah, and we should think and try to understand the best of our ability. But ultimately, we have to say, well, this is what I think, but what do the greater commentaries say? And why do they say what they say? Where are they coming from? And how does that fit into the text? But when it's all in context, it's all based on tradition, you have a much more powerful way of understanding it. It's well-sourced. It has there's weight behind it because it's being built up on generations of study, not just on my own personal thoughts that happened over a course of a day or a week or a month. And that's the idea, is to take everything in, look at all those details, look at the context, and understand it in it from a much more complex and deeper perspective. For instance, we said some examples before. What exactly was the test given to Adam and Chava? Why is it that the first two human beings on the face of the planet are created, and they're given one challenge, don't eat the fruit of that tree? So what did God want out of that? Why was it so challenging? What caused them to fail? If you just read the verses, you don't fully get that. That's not clear. It just, again, it seems very basic. But obviously, there's a lot to it, especially in the context. Now, what would God do with the very first human being? Why would this be the challenge of history? And what's the role of the snake in the challenge? I mean, we can ask many questions, which we will ask the questions and try to give at least some understanding of it. What exactly was the sin of the Dor Mabul, the generation of the flood? So we know God brought a flood upon the world, and he destroyed all of humanity. most of the animals, besides the ones remaining in the ark. So what exactly did they do wrong? The Torah gives a little description, but it's just in a few words, not so clear. What did they do wrong? And why was the way they got saved by building a large ship? And what exactly happened in that story? So again, from the simple verses, you picture sort of like a comic book story, but it's a very simple, like a children's story, as it were. A guy got mad, he brought a flood, they built a boat, the animals were saved, and everyone's happy. But obviously, we're talking about a much more complex situation. For God to want to destroy the world, there must have been a real motivation for that. I mean, God made the world, and to destroy an entire world is a big deal. Why he saved them in that manner, what was the merit that Noach was the one who was saved, and his family, that has to be dealt with. God says that, and it says in the Torah that he was a tzaddik tamim. He was a completely righteous person. But what made him righteous? And was no one else in the entire world righteous besides that he's the only one? So yeah, those are all questions that have to be addressed. Just in the simple story. I'm not getting into anything. I don't plan on getting too much into midrashim or things like that. Just to understand simply these stories. What are the messages that are being conveyed? We know that Avraham's greatest challenge was the Akedah, supposed to bring his son as a sacrifice. So, I mean, what was the challenge there exactly? Again, we can relate to it on a simple level. Obviously, sacrificing a child would be a heart-wrenching experience. We understand that. Why would God give him that challenge versus any other challenge? What was Avraham's attitude towards it? Nothing's so clear. Those questions are not so clear in the Torah itself. The Torah says, God says, bring your son. Avraham says, okay. They go, he tries to kill him, and he's stopped. That's the story. It's a very simple story. We can appreciate why it's challenging for Abraham, and we can appreciate the result at the end. But again, the details are fuzzy, and the depth of the challenge. Now, there's nothing which is just random. Everything has there's a reason for it. Another example, we know that Yaakov has to go in and steal the brachos, the blessings from his father, rather than Esav. So, again, why did Yitzhak want to give blessings to Esav? Why must Yaakov steal them? These are very basic questions and stories, but in our head, these stories remain just as very simple stories, and there's so much more to them. I'm not going to get too detailed in the text, in the text itself, which is always worthwhile, but that's not my plan in this class. We're not going to have time to delve into every single commentary. It's also not for this class. But at least to utilize some of the commentaries, and just get a deeper handle on the issues at play, I think we'll all gain a lot from that. Because I think it'll just help to move our understanding of Torah to the next level, which is everyone wants to do that. We have to understand that the Torah has many, many layers. Each layer is a layer, each layer has a truth to it, but it goes deeper and deeper and deeper. There's a work called Sifsei Chaim, written by Rav Chaim Friedlander Zatzal, who was a mashgiach in the Panovich Yeshiva in Bnei Brak. He died fairly young, but he was looked at as a world-renowned Jewish thinker in his time. So he put out a bunch of works called Sifsei Chaim. Some were put up posthumously, some in his lifetime, I think. But he has there two pieces. There's two points to keep in mind when you're studying stories of the Torah. Two major points. So we have to keep these in mind as we study every story of the Torah. Number one, if anything's expressed in the Torah, that means there's a goal. Why did God say put this in the Torah? Maybe for example, Avraham Avinu woke up in the morning, and he probably said good morning to Sarah. I assume he had breakfast. He got dressed. The Torah doesn't record all that. I'm sure Sarah had to go shopping at times, she probably prepared dinner. We have that one time, that she prepares dinner. That's one time in the Torah. But in general, these things are not, those are not described because they're not significant for us. Now, those are not messages the Torah is giving us for an eternal lesson. If God deemed, well, this should go into the Torah, that means that something about this story or this detail is eternal. It's a lesson, it's a message, has to be there for everybody to study eternally. So when you look at it, you have to understand this Torah is expressing something with every single story, both in the details, in the way it's told, and how it's told. But everything's expressing something. Because the Torah is supposed to, the word Torah itself comes from the word like a morah, a teacher. Torah is teachings. It's supposed to be teachings. And if we have the, it's meant to be teachings for us. And if they're not teachings, then there's no reason it should be there. So therefore, everything is a teaching. That's number one. Number two, as we said before, you have to know who are these people. Who are we talking about? Understand the people. Understand their level and their role. like we said before, I can't just view, you know, Avraham is not like me. No, Avraham is somebody who is on a much higher level than I am. So I can't view Avraham's actions as what would I do. I have to look at him and say, well, he was a person on a very high level. I'm not on that level, but let's understand why he did what he did. Nothing to do with me. But if we project ourselves into it and don't appreciate the people, we've also missed out on a lot. So you have that, with any character you find in the Torah, the reason they're in the Torah is because they're a high-level person. They have a major impact on eternity, on the entire world, and therefore you have to appreciate them in that way. That's Rav Chaim Friedland. There's two different points to keep in mind as you study Torah. So number one is that you have to know the goal. Every single story has an expression and a goal. And number two, understand the people involved, understand who they are, and what they are, and why they're there, and what level they're on. And that might take some time to understand, well, where did the person come from? Why does the Torah hold them up on a pedestal as being such an impressive, you know, significant individual in history? And then from there, you can kind of understand better what are their challenges, what are their accomplishments, what's their role in the Torah. That's an important point. Additionally, I'd like to clarify, I guess, some other pieces that go into studying Chumash. Again, you can study Chumash in many different ways. There's many approaches to how to study Chumash, but I think there's some basic pieces involved in studying the Chumash we have to understand. Number one, there is a principle the Gemara gives, Ein Mikro Yotzi Bepshuto, that every pasuk has to be taken at face value as well. I mean, there's nothing in the Torah that we're going to say the simple meaning is not right, is not true. We just have to know that there's more behind it. You know, that this is just sort of a handle on a bigger event. But we can't ignore the simple meaning of a pasuk. If you were to say that, no, that pasuk is not literal, it's just some sort of metaphor, it didn't really happen in that way, so then we're denying one layer of Torah. Because one layer of Torah is that as things happen as said. That's number one, and we can't ignore that. So as you study, even if you go to a deeper level, it always has to tie back into what the verse actually says. Because if it doesn't tie into the verse, then it's standing on nothing. There's no solid ground for it, because the verse itself is the solid ground for Torah. That's number one. Number two is that the language is very significant. In this class, I don't plan to get too much into the words of the text, but Lashon HaKodesh, you know, the Hebrew language used in Torah, is that is the language meant for Torah. And the expressions given in Lashon HaKodesh carryeth in them a lot of weight. Whether it be a synonym used for a certain action or a certain word, whether it be the words themselves, how they're arranged in a pasuk, that all makes a big difference. There's a discussion amongst the commentators, why do we refer to Hebrew as Lashon HaKodesh, the holy language? And there's two major approaches. The Rambam says Hebrew is called a holy language because there's no dirty words in Hebrew. So nowadays they've invented dirty words. You know, in modern Ivrit they have dirty words because they've invented dirty words. But the Rambam says that Hebrew has no dirty words. It's a clean language. The Ramban says no, you do find that there might be words that you might refer to as, you know, dirty, or words that are a little, I don't know, off color, but the words that describe things that, you know, that we don't want to talk about publicly. But he says that the reason that Torah is called the holy language, that Hebrew is called the holy language, is because it's the language designated for conveying holy ideas. We know in general in the world, so certain languages are known to have a certain flavor or character to them. People talk about like French as being romantic or something, or, you know, maybe certain languages convey technical concepts better than other languages. Yeshivas in the past few hundred years have put a lot of focus on Yiddish, and a lot of the ideas that they speak about in yeshivas were developed through the Yiddish language, so a lot of times those Yiddish terms do convey things better than other languages would, because that's where the concepts originated. They originated in Yiddish. So the languages have what they're good at portraying. So Hebrew may not be good for everything. There's a reason, I think, why modern Ivrit had to develop some vocabulary that wasn't there from the Torah. But on the other hand, Hebrew is the best language to convey the thoughts of Torah and spirituality and these ideas. That's why it's Lashon HaKodesh, the Ramban says. And therefore, when you're learning Torah in translation, you are missing out on that aspect. It's important to always look back and say, what does the word actually say in the Pasuk? What does it mean? And it gives you a very different look and different understanding than when you look at it in translation. So that's the second point. So again, we're not going to get too textual in this class anyways, but it's always important to know that the language does make a significant difference. Number three, we have to know that the Torah is using its words to express, as we said before, deeper thoughts. That it's the knowledge of God Himself. So if you look at anything, this is just a simple thing. The answer is, well, this is God talking. Obviously, He's expressing something much, much deeper than that. Number four, as we said also, I'm just kind of recapping, the words of Chazal, the oral tradition, they're meant to give us a deeper look at the text. Now, there's a lot of different approaches to Midrashim. And, you know, what's the role of a Midrash? And the role can change. Some Midrashim are meant to convey a simple idea in terms of history or context. Some Midrashim might convey a deeper philosophical idea. Some Midrashim are meant to be metaphors, some are meant to be literal. You have to be an expert, really, on studying Midrashim to know where each one finds its place. But the oral tradition, like I said before, is meant to give us a deeper look and a context to Torah. You know, for instance, you know, Avram Avinu, he comes on the scene with no introduction, really. There is Avram's born, and suddenly God speaks to Avram and says, you know, Lech Lecha, get out of here, go to Eretz Canaan. But we have no context for who he was, why God spoke to him and anybody else. The Torah doesn't say. There's no information on that. So there's a reason why the Torah might leave that detail out, which could be discussed. But where do you find the context, the background information? The oral tradition. We have Midrashim, we have oral tradition telling us, well, who was he? Why did God speak to him? What were his accomplishments as a youth that actually earned him the privilege of God speaking to him? Where did that come from? So that's not anywhere in the words themselves, the Chumash. That's in the Midrash. That's where you find it. So you have to know. So that Midrash, those Midrashim likely are understood to be literal, historical, and they give us context. Other Midrashim might say, you know, when Abraham did X action, it connects with this other context, you know, this other verse, this other, you know, discussion you find in the prophets somewhere. And that's meant to tell us a deeper aspect of understanding Avram's actions. And every Midrash has its context, but those give us really a deeper look at the text. Also, when we look at commentaries, so it's important for us to understand who are the commentaries that we're looking at. And maybe as we go through and I quote people, we'll try to discuss, you know, what their role is. But traditionally, some commentators are called more mainstream than others. Some carry more weight than others in terms of understanding. Some based on chronology or based on, you know, the acceptance they've had amongst the Jews and how widespread they've been used and, you know, what the great sages have actually appreciated as the great commentaries. You know, we all know Rashi has sort of become the primary commentary on the Chumash and also on the Gemara and also on Nach mostly. There's reason for that. And even though Rashi might say things that some of the commentaries might argue with, you know, question, but Rashi's been accepted as sort of like, you know, the first go-to source for any simple meaning of a pasuk. So there's discussion over, you know, why that is, but that certainly has become the tradition, and there's a reason for that. There's a reason that certain commentaries have become more primary than others. You know, I mentioned Ramban, for instance, being really one of the major sources for commentary on the Chumash. You have, let's say, the Ibn Ezra has his place. And those commentaries sort of taken their front seat, you know, in the way that we study Torah. Some commentaries you can dust off the shelf in the library and also speak about the Torah, but they haven't been given that same significance as these commentaries. So it's important that we take that into mind. Which commentaries have history, have the scholars of the Jewish people accepted, and which ones have they kind of pushed off as a library piece and not to be the ones on a daily basis? It's important to know that. Also, as you get a more of a sense for commentaries, you understand the difference between what we call Rishon versus Nacharon. A Rishon is a commentator that lived approximately between, let's say, the year 1000 and 1500 or so. Post that, we call an Acharon, a later commentary. But, you know, the way that it's been understood is that they really have very different roles. I mean, a Rishon's words carry a lot more weight. And certainly, if there's something novel being said, which is a chiddush, something which is unique, if a Rishon says it, it carries a lot of weight. If somebody lived 50 years ago says it, it carries less weight. Not to take away from that person, it might be a great Torah scholar who said it, but the fact that you're living now, you're not living back then, and we are who we are, and they were who they were, it makes a difference. It does make a difference. If someone comes out right now in 2019 and says some radically different approach to the Chumash, we look at them with a very cynical eye. You know, we'd question them, and maybe eventually they'd prove their point, and we'd say that makes sense. The person has that scholarship and that weight that would accept them, but that person has a lot of proving to do. Whereas if, you know, Ramban says something, we take it very seriously, and we say even though this Ramban may not have such a strong source, we don't cast it aside because this is the Ramban talking. You know, there's a way in which the study has developed, and that certain ideas and certain people have taken a front seat, and their words become more of a primary source, let's call it. And then some people, their words have become, you know, something to think about, food for thought, a cherry on top, but it's not a primary source as to what happened. So it's just, again, we'll try to put it more into context as we go through, but it's important to have that context. Yeah.
You said that Rashi's primary source for, you know, Chumash and Gemara, I understand. But for Navi, we don't use Rashi.
Navi not as much, as I said. Yeah, Tanakh not as much, I said. But yeah.
The Radak and Malbim.
Right, yeah, correct. Like right, it's interesting because the Malbim lived relatively recently. Yeah. You know, Masudis also was much later than Rashi. But yeah, it's true. But Rashi in Nach is not as used as Rashi. He is used, but not as much as in Chumash or as in the Gemara. That's 100% right. It's interesting because there's a reason which why we've gravitated towards certain commentaries and pushed aside others. You know, they're different. I think the Chazan Ish was known to have discussed that point. Like, why have certain commentaries become accepted, used, mainstream, and others haven't? Not because people were any worse people. Not because they weren't great people and they weren't scholars. But just so the style, the concepts, the ideas. Some have become kind of mainstream and part of how we study, and some just haven't. It doesn't mean they're wrong. It doesn't mean you can't look at them. It just means that, you know, there's a starting point. There's a default. Typically, a kid in school, when he's learning Chumash, default's going to be Chumash and what Rashi says. Now, as you grow to learn more, then you say, oh, but someone has a question about what Rashi says. You know, so someone has a proof against Rashi. There's a different approach to this. But there's a baseline. And the baseline's always going to be Chumash and Rashi. That seems to be the baseline. There's no commentary that's going to start discussing anything without first saying, what did Rashi say about it? That's pretty much across the board. You build it up. You know, this is what the Torah says. This is Rashi's approach. But X, Y, and Z, I have to question Rashi. Or I have to disprove Rashi. Or I have to support Rashi. But those are going to be your baseline right now. And there's a reason, because you have to have a baseline understanding. And the baseline is not what we think. Baseline is how the commentaries have digested over the years. So that's kind of the role of the commentaries. And with this all together, they help give us the correct approach and to understand the verses in a way which gives us the ability to understand what's happening. So now if you take that all into account, you look back at the story, you say, oh, now I see a much different approach to the story. I see there's a deeper thing happening here. I see the challenge, the accomplishment, you know, the story itself carries with it much more weight than I ever thought before when I just read the simple verses. There's a verse that says, "Lo davar reku mikem." It's the literal meaning is that the Torah is not. There's nothing about the Torah that's empty. You know, everything about the Torah has something to offer you. And the rabbis they use what we call it a sort of play on words, a drasha, and they say, "Vim reku mikem hu reik." And if you think it's empty, you're the empty one. Meaning, when we look at the Torah and we say that, oh, this looks meaningless to me. This verse seems to have no purpose. This verse seems to have no meaning. This story seems to be a random story with no lesson. The answer is, the Torah is not empty, but your understanding is empty. And it's up to you to figure out, what does God mean here? Because God's not empty. And therefore, if God said it, then obviously there's something to be learned. So every story is significant. I want to read to you quickly, just a quote from the Rambam, Maimonides, in Mor Nevuchim. The guy for the perplexed. Now, the Rambam, he wrote a lot. One of his primary works that are appreciated is Mor Nevuchim. Mor Nevuchim was more of his philosophical work. And Mor Nevuchim, one of his big topics is to discuss these stories which often seem to have details that might not be meaningful, stories in Chumash that may not really understand the context. And he goes through, he talks about, he gives you some reasons why they're said as they're said, what's their purpose. But he also gives an introduction to it. And the Rambam says, you know, there are things here which are really, you know, basics of Torah, but people stumble over them. And he says, that's the stories that Torah tells that the people think have no benefit. And he goes and lists a bunch of the stories that people might question. I'm not going to read that part right now. We'll get to the stories as we learn through. But then he says, I want to tell you one thing. And then we'll go through the details. He says, every story that you find written in the Torah is a necessity and for a benefit. Whether it is to help to give us a proper understanding of truth, whether it's to help us improve our actions as people so that we act appropriately, but they're going to have a message. So he breaks it down into really two categories. We'll call it, you know, philosophy and action. And one is that we should have the proper perspective on the world, to understand how the world works, how God's interaction with the world works, how people interact with one another, and then wants to help us improve ourselves practically. this is a lesson that I have to take in so that I can then develop myself in my own personal character, in my own midos. And that's the other part of it. But every story will fit into one of those two categories. So either trying to give us a proper understanding of the world, proper perspective, or it's helping us practically develop ourselves. One of those two. But it's not going to be, there's nothing in the Torah that's just a detail that's meaningless. And this is actually something that, you know, some of our greatest heretics have been upset about, because they'll say, why does the Torah say this line or that line or the other line? The rabbis speak about Menashe Mel, the King Menashe. King Menashe was one of the most wicked kings, could be the most wicked king we had in the prophets. He's discussed in the Book of Kings. And the rabbis say that Menashe would question, you know, lines of the Torah. What's the purpose of this line? What's the purpose of that line? Why do I care that, you know, Achos Lotan Timna was an example. Why do I care that the sister of Lotan was Timna? Now, no one probably knows who Lotan or Timna was anyways. You know, and then how do I care who his sister was? So that was one of his different, that was a basis he used to reject Torah and foul idolatry. So there's an answer to all of that. And the Rambam himself gives answers, and many commentators give answers to all those questions. But everything in Torah is going to have its place, every detail, every word. So certainly the broader stories are easier to understand. The details themselves often require a little bit more work to understand each detail. But it's all meaningful, and it's all true, and it all has a message for us. So we have to then figure out, analyze, you know, and pull out. What is the essence? What's the lesson of this story? With all that in mind, I don't plan to focus too much on the actual text. You know, we can look at it at times, for sure. I don't plan to get too much into Midrashim. That's a different class, a different time. But I want to really look at the stories, I guess kind of ask the basic questions that come to mind. You know, because every story that we read, we do have questions. You know, as little kids, we don't think about the questions. But as adults, you read and say, well, that's kind of strange. Why did that happen? You know, what's going on over there? Who is this person anyways? And try to understand better what's the Torah expressing. And we'll see that the words of the commentaries really do open up the stories in ways which, you know, if we haven't looked at them before, that we're not aware of these different layers which are there. So that's the goal of the class. I guess we'll stop with that. Next week we'll actually get into a story. So that's
our question. Yeah. You mentioned the Adam and Eve.